Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I have the fabulous Christopher with me today, and also we have a pretty awesome guest. And Chris is going to tell us exactly who we've got on. Who have we got on, Chris?
Yes, today we have Timothy Ryback, who is a historian and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague, who specialises in European history and politics, and whose previous works include Hitler's First Victims and The Last Survivor in the Search of Martin Seidenstadt. And he's here today to talk to us about his new book, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. Tim, welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Welcome. Thank you very much.
I think we've hit the gold mine, Chris, haven't you, with Tim?
Yeah, we've had a brief chat about Nazism already and having a drink, so it's all good.
Tim, I'm really excited to talk to you because we get to laugh at some historians who really write some total crap about Hitler. So I don't even know where to start with this. I think I'm going to make Chris start with this. Go on, Chris, kick us off with something.
I thought we'd probably sort of start at the beginning because there's this belief that the Nazis had this roadmap to power and that they powered through and it was all some master plan. But, you know, in the middle of the 1920s, or even up until like 1928, 1929, the party's pretty dead. So what kind of changes for them?
Well, I think first of all, you know, when you talk about sort of this sense of inevitability or this organized movement, I think that comes out of the nature of history itself or history writing. You have to take the facts that help explain how we get to where we ended up. And so it gives a sense of inevitability, and we have all of these images of the Nazis once they were in power, of these, you know, the ranks of SS men or the Nazi party rallies and all of that. You're right in that it was a much more chaotic type of movement. There was much more divisiveness within the movement, and, you know, in particular, it wasn't inevitable. It was actually highly unlikely that they would have succeeded. And I think that the most amazing part about all of this is that Hitler actually managed to come to power amidst all this chaos. Why? Part of it was driven by the economics of the time. Another, I think, element to it was the self-serving nature of politicians at the time. And it was an unfortunate collision of circumstance and events. There's actually there's an interesting story here by that Hans Frank, who was Hitler's private attorney, just before, and he was then the governor general of Poland, you know, implicated, responsible for so much of Nazi atrocity. And right before he was hanged at Nuremberg, he said something really interesting, which was, you know, we Nazis came to power at the only moment when it would have been possible. Had we tried this 10 years earlier, the German people would simply have gone back to the Kaiser. Had we tried this 10 years later, there would have been a full generation of Germans imbued with democratic values. But we came at this perfect moment in 1933 when the German people were too far from the past to retreat into back to the Kaiser, but not far enough to save themselves, not far enough in the future to save themselves with democracy. And so I think it was an incredibly fragile moment. And I do think, you know, Hans Frank, for every fault he had, actually made a really interesting observation about those dynamics. Unfortunately, he was hanged right after that, but got what he deserved.
I mean, the worst thing about all of this is that all of these people who helped bring Hitler to power were all very well-educated people. Hans Frank, like you just said, he was a lawyer. And people ended up having PhDs and all sorts of degrees. And it's just mind-blowing when you think about it. People usually think, oh, those Nazis were just, you know, run-of-the-mill job Bob from down the street who worked on a farm. No, these were highly well-educated people that managed to get this to happen.
Some of them, and some of them were just street thugs, and Hitler had this strange capacity to bring, as you said, highly educated, well-trained individuals, but along with really these, you know, people like Ernst Röhm, that you were just, you know, essentially street thugs. And he bridged both those and eventually, actually, in the course of his rise to power, engaged with aristocrats as well. So he had this ability to span society in a tragic but really quite remarkable way. We need to throw in the industrialists as well. Fritz Thyssen, you know, at the head of the list, top of the list.
Is he? And you had the Kaiser's sons courting him as well, sort of after 1933, in the hope that maybe they could use Hitler to try and bring back the Hohenzollern, but Hitler wasn't going to have any of it.
Well, actually, some of these people with whom Hitler engaged, there were some very interesting dynamics there, because one thing that was overlooked in the telling of these, you know, last 6 months of the Weimar Republic was the fact that some of these people who were pretending to be allies with Hitler were actually working behind the scenes to undermine them. One of the aha moments for me, or real, truly surprising moments for me, was the discovery of a mole in the Brown House, the Nazi Party headquarters in Munich, who was feeding internal intelligence into, to Hitler, some of Hitler's key opponents, so they actually understood more about the internal dynamics within the party than Hitler was aware of. And the amazing thing is this mole was never outed in the course of the Third Reich. I mean, he was never discovered. So there were who that is, you have to read the book to find out. But no, it was really, and I actually, when I came across this, I said, wow, what is going on here? And started digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And then finally, you know, it seemed to me that there really was someone who was fairly close to Hitler and was feeding this intelligence up to some of his key opponents in Berlin. I checked it out with some very credible German historians who also confirmed this. It's just one of these overlooked facts of history, but you ignore it when you're trying to show how Hitler came to power. You simply look at all those steps along the way that led to it, rather than when you take it day by day and you're looking at it sort of from the trench view, the way it was being experienced day by day. Suddenly you come across these things, you go, wow, looks what was going on there.
Talking of opponents, everyone's heard of Hindenburg, or they better had, if they're having a conversation with me, and von Papen, but Kurt Schleicher is one of those guys who sort of slips through the radar. So, I mean, who was he and how important was he against the Nazis?
Well, Kurt von Schleicher was the guy who planted this mole in the Brown House and the intelligence was being fed to him. He was in his day, let's say in the 1930s, he was considered the ultimate power broker in Berlin politics. Because he had the trust of Hindenburg, who was president at the time and had represented the state, had the ultimate authority. He had the Article 53 powers to appoint and dismiss chancellors at will. But it was Schleicher who had Hindenburg's ear and was really the ultimate power broker in Berlin at the time. And it was no secret. I mean, the New York Times did a full page story on Schleicher as this, although he was a military man, he had sort of these piercing eyes of a calculating businessman, who for him, it really was, manipulation, using information and intelligence and playing everybody, including Adolf Hitler, who ultimately ended up being, I should add maybe that, he was ultimately hoisted by his own petard, but that we can talk about that in a bit, I guess.
Yeah. not in a good way. As you said, so we've got the shrewd politicians. I don't want to give them too much credit within the Nazi Party, but you've also, as you said, we've also got the street gangs. The SA become quite powerful. I mean, they're going around just straight out murdering people. I've forgotten the guy's name. He was one of the heads of the Communist Parties, where they just beat him to death. How is this able to happen, and what are the state trying to do to stop it?
Well, it's there. The country by the late 1920s, there was a civil war taking place between basically the far right and the far left. The country was awash in rifles, in machine guns, hand grenades, everything. There were the newspapers by August of 1932 were publishing casualty lists of what they were calling the country's ongoing civil war. The interesting thing is, in one of the cabinet meetings in early August of that year, they sat down and talked about introducing gun control legislation to bring this under control. And ultimately, one proposal was to introduce the death sentence for anyone who was convicted of political murder, using a weapon. And one of the objections to it in the cabinet meeting was that it would basically turn the courts into death machines because there were so many political murders taking place. And the country was so awash in weapons that it would be impossible to bring it under control. I mean, when you're reading these newspaper accounts, it does not sound unlike the discussions that are taking place in America with gun control. And the interesting thing is it was, there's talk about very similar types of legislation, but also the impossibility to bring it under control.
Yeah, it's once the guns are out there, it's very difficult to get them all back in. But as well, because ever since of 1919 and the collapse of the Second Reich, you've got so many political groups just forming their own paramilitary, the communists, the Freikorps, then the Nazis. It's just literally endemic, and it just hasn't gone away.
Yeah, and it isn't just Nazis killing communists. I mean, we need to keep in mind the communist threat was very real at the time. Mm-hmm. Moscow was helping to fund this. Arms were being brought in over the Czechoslovak border. They were coming in through Switzerland, through Belgium. I mean, there all of this. The communists were arming themselves for an armed revolt. So when Hitler talked about the communist threat, it was a very real threat to the country. And probably one thing to mention here, this gets mentioned in history, but I think one cannot underestimate the impact it had in particular on Hindenburg and his final decision to appoint Hitler chancellor, but it was something called the Spielplan Ott, and Major Ott was in the German military in late November, early December of 1932. He was given an assignment to say what would happen if civil war broke out between the communists and the Nazis, if it really came to an armed conflict. The German army at the time was restricted by the Treaty of Versailles to 100,000 men. Had war broke out, open warfare broke out between communists and the Nazis, Spielplan Ott, you know, Ott then suggested that the Poles, where there was a lot of tension along the Polish border, would use this opportunity to invade parts of disputed territory, and that the German army military would not have the capacity to both quell a civil war and defend the German borders at the same time, and you would have had a complete collapse of the state. And this was presented to Hindenburg. It was taken seriously within quarters. Schleicher was behind this, and it was a very self-serving kind of document, but it really did lay out a worst-case scenario, but a not unrealistic scenario for what the Germans were facing at the time.
I want to add a little bit to this border dispute comment, because this is something that a lot of Western historians don't tend to bring into their books very often, or into articles or whatever they write or even speak about when it comes to the rise of the Nazi Party, is that how much of a shit show East and Central Europe really was with these borders, and how many constant uprisings were happening between the Poles and the Germans, between the Poles and the Soviets, the Poles and the Czechs. Everybody thought they were screwed by the Treaty of Versailles, and each country had its claims to X, Y, and Z, and that country believes that it has claims to Silesia, but no, Silesia belongs to the Germans, no, Wiener it belongs to the Poles. It is absolute, complete and total chaos at that stage.
And Alina, what I would add there, you're absolutely right. The border between Poland, first of all, a lot of German territories historically were annexed to Poland. They were mixed, but the Treaty of Versailles drew a line, and parts of the traditional German Reich were truncated at that point. The border became fairly fluid at certain points, and you had a lot of Poles who were actually coming to Germany to find work. And it became a fairly fluid thing. There was the most important case. This is sort of what Charlottesville was to America's wake-up call. There was something in a little town called Potempa, a mile from the Polish-German border in Silesia. A group of nine or so Nazis and right-wing Germans went in and beat to death a Polish worker. This was right after the Germans had implemented this law for calling for death sentences for political murder. It went to trial. It was a huge thing. When you read the press, it was making regular headlines. It drew international attention. And these Germans, these nine Germans, were put on trial for the murder of a Polish worker who was living in Germany. One of Hitler's political promises was that if you elect me, if I am elected, never would I put a German life above that of a foreign immigrant. And this had strong resonance. It also, with Hindenburg, when he heard this, I mean, Hindenburg was no friend of Hitler, but it was, the interesting thing is, Hitler let his position on these issues be known with absolute clarity. It was appalling to a lot of people, and also to the political establishment, because Hitler was basically saying at that point, and this is what, September, October 1932, that he was putting aside rule of law. And under him, you know, it was Germans above all else. We saw the longer term consequences of that. But you're right about this disputed border and the complexity of it. Because the immigration issue was a huge one on the German agenda. You know, there was the conditions of Versailles. There was the economy, but there was also the, especially from the East, the presence of these foreigners, immigrants coming into the country.
Trying not to quote the national anthem there, which is basically the Uber Alles and all that. But I'm not going to sing it. But moving sort of back to the chronology of it, there's quite an important date. For me, 13th of August is always 13th of August 1914, Edeltag with the attack on Britain. But in 1932, the 13th of August is quite important as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I call it Saturday the 13th. It was on July 31st, they had the Reichstag elections. The Nazis did sensationally well. They doubled the number of mandates in the Reichstag. They ended up with 37% of the electorate, which made them hands down the single largest political party in the country. Hindenburg had vowed never to appoint Hitler chancellor. Hitler was frustrated because anyone who led historically, traditionally in the country, anyone with the majority party ended up being appointed chancellor. So Hitler's sitting there with Goebbels complaining, saying, well, what about me? Comes a phone call for Hitler from Kurt von Schleicher. And he says, I think I can work a deal. I think I can convince Hindenburg to make you chancellor. So Hitler in a most tools up to Berlin for this meeting with Hindenburg. Hindenburg doesn't know anything about this. He's had several previous meetings with Hitler. I think famously we know that, you know, he was called him the Bohemian Corporal. You see the protocol of his very first meeting with Hitler. This corporal comes in to see this former field marshal and president of the country, and Hitler just goes on a tirade for an hour. When Hitler walks out, Hindenburg turns to someone and says, you know, who was that man? Don't ever do that to me again. There were a couple of other meetings. You know, suddenly Hitler has 37% of the electorate. Can we come up with some arrangement? So Hitler, when Hindenburg finds out about this, he basically dismisses out of hand. He says, I told you, I'm not appointing this guy. Hitler comes in and basically says, let me talk to him. Hitler assumes that since Hindenburg's willing to talk to him, the answer, there's a possibility that Hindenburg's going to make him chancellor. The whole thing turns into a debacle. Hindenburg basically this time reads Hitler the Riot Act, and he says, for the sake of God, my country, and my conscience, I would never appoint you chancellor. It becomes a debacle for Hitler. Oh, but what he does offer, he said, one of the suggestions is that Hitler become vice chancellor under von Papen, can serve in that role. And if he behaves himself, he can basically decide. And Hitler is, as we know, he's just an all or nothing double down politician. And Hitler walks out. His logic on this is, you know, it's whoever gets a majority in the Reichstag gets to be chancellor. Hitler says, I have 37% of 51%, which is 75%. So using Hitler's democratic mathematics, I should be chancellor. Hitler walks out. and says, okay, you want 51%? I will get 51%. And they go into another round of elections in November, for November of 32. Hitler leases, Hitler has a problem. One is that he's banned from the radio waves, so he cannot reach the broad public on radio. He also, the major newspapers are not covering him, and he's stuck in his own echo chamber with the Völkische Beobachter and the other Nazi newspapers. So what he does is to lease a Lufthansa passenger plane. And he starts, it's literally the first German politician to ever do this. With a car and train, he would have done one or two cities a day. He's able to cover, hold up to five rallies in a single day. And he just sets out to get 51% of the electorate. He'd done a number of these in 1932. He held over 200 rallies like that. Sometimes he's landing in a farmer's field and walking into a village and giving a talk. I mean, he's going to places that most German politicians have never heard of. So he really is going into heartland Germany. He covers something like, according to his press secretary, he covers like 20,000 miles, which is sort of circumnavigating the globe. And ends up seeing, once again, according to the Nazi press, 15 million Germans face-to-face, which is a quarter of the population. As they approach the November 4th election, they predict an absolute landslide. His press secretary says, look, we've been to the most remote parts of Germany, and everywhere we go, we're met with a fanatic response. People want change. And so come November 4th, people come to the polls, and it's an absolute debacle for the Nazis. They lose 2 million votes. They're down to 190 mandates, and they were at like 230. They go down to, I think the number was around 190. Half of that 1 million go off to the communists. Another million goes off to the right-wing thing. More importantly, Hitler has basically bankrupted the party. It had cost him, he burned through something like, it's estimated, 60 million marks in the political campaigns of that year leading up to the moment, which in today's numbers would be like $230 million. So the party starts hemorrhaging money. It's bankrupt. That's where we are at going into December of 1932. Worse still, the worst news comes, that this is Schleicher at work again, Kurt von Schleicher, has offered the vice chancellorship to a man named Gregor Strasser, who was the number two man in the Nazi party. People start saying about Hitler, er hat verspielt, Hitler misplayed his cards. And my favorite quote about commentary about him was from a political commentator who said, Hitler is a man with a great future behind him. And he was seen by December. He was, you know, basically seen as washed up. Then he gets word that Schleicher has offered Hitler, and Schleicher has offered Strasser the vice chancellorship. Absolute crisis in the party. Hitler says, if this happens, I will put a bullet through my head in 3 minutes. Unfortunately, he didn't keep that political promise. But the party goes into a crisis. By January of 1933, Hitler is bankrupt politically, bankrupt financially, and basically ideologically because the party has split. Within a month, the man's appointed chancellor. And that's where, but you know, when you're following this on a day-to-day basis, starting in mid-August, you see one political catastrophe, one political misstep on Hitler's part after another. The worst part, one of the worst parts, is that the German economy is basically beginning to stabilize. There were a number of provisions of Versailles, which had been amended through negotiations. The economy was beginning to stabilize, and had there been another 6 months, Hitler truly would have been a has-been, you know, as they say, you know, the man with a great future behind him.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
But that's not January 33. You know, things changed.
Well, I wanted to talk about, I mean, we've hit the nail on the head now. Hitler's been appointed chancellor. And for me, it's quite important to look at what other people, so other countries, thought of Hitler becoming chancellor. I can already tell you from Poland's perspective, Piłsudski thought Hitler was an idiot. Pretty straightforward and easy from the Polish perspective. But I mean, what are the British, what are the American, what are the French thinking at this point?
Well, what are the Germans thinking? The German ambassador to the UK, to the Court of St. James's, goes in to Whitehall. There's a record of this, and he basically says, Hitler, my new chancellor, is a madman. Be careful. It was one of the most interesting things is how he was viewed by the United States, but also how Hitler viewed himself. And he rarely gave interviews with American journalists, but there were a couple they did. He gave this one where there was another political leader who came to power at the same time. In America, there was a man named Franklin D. Roosevelt who had just been elected president. And Hitler basically was saying at that time, you know, both of us have countries that are in peril, that are in economic despair, and pulling out these alleged similarities. And he even sent one of his cabinet members over for a meeting with Roosevelt. We know where all that went, but I think in some cases there was absolute panic, but I think in a lot of cases there was true dismay. And from the most optimistic people, we're still looking at Hindenburg. And one of the phrases was, well, Hitler was in power, and this was the logic for appointing him, was, you know, soup is always cooked much hotter than it's actually consumed. So Hitler would calm down. Franz von Papen, who was the vice chancellor and helped engineer this, had said, don't worry, we've got Hitler boxed in a corner until he squeaks. Most importantly, Hindenburg had his Article 53 powers, which meant that he could appoint and dismiss chancellors at will. And in the course of 1932, he had done this with Brüning, with Papen, and then with Schleicher. So three chancellorships within, 9 or 10 months, nothing was stopping him from making Hitler the fourth. So I think there was a lot of dismay on the part of individuals, but also, you know, a sense that there were enough constitutional structures in place. Most of the cabinet were conservative centrists, well, very conservative, but still centrist, and that they sort of had Hitler boxed in. Hindenburg's one condition on appointing Hitler chancellor was that he would never be left alone or in a room. He'd never be left in a room alone with that man, you know, with the Bohemian corporal. So it was, I mean, Hindenburg did this. I, to a certain degree, you know, one needs to wonder to what degree this Spielplan Ott, you know, this scenario, this catastrophic scenario was also on his mind, and keeping the thing together. For Hitler, it was an absolute lifeline. It saved his political career.
Yeah, as you said, by Christmas sort of 1932, everything's dead. What sort of changed it around so that he could take up the position of Chancellor? And has it got anything to do with a little Dutchman called van der Lubbe?
Well, this is where I will say that my, I hope you still read the book, but my book ends at 11 o'clock in the morning on Monday, January 30th, the moment Hindenburg appoints Hitler chancellor. We know what happens after that, and there, you know, there are questions about to what degree any of this could have done. In that previous August, when Hitler was about to go in and see Hindenburg for that August 13th, you know, debacle, Goebbels had written in his diary, "Once we're in power, we will never leave. They will have to drag us out as corpses." So my argument is, regardless of what would have happened, once Hitler was in place, anything, it would have taken basically a civil war or a military coming in to extract the Nazis. He was helped by your Dutchman van der Lubbe, the burning of the Reichstag, you know, which was the moment then when all civil liberties were suspended. And this is the point where I have great sympathy for Hindenburg. I will admit to that. This was a man who retired before the First World War. He'd served his country well. This war breaks out. He's called back into service. He serves the military, becomes, you know, field marshal, you know, the great, you know, Hindenburg. As soon as it's over, he goes back into retirement. You know, he writes his memoirs, but he just, you know, he's second time he retires. Come 1925, the country's back in crisis. He's a monarchist at heart, but they ask him, he's the one person who can stabilize the country, so they ask him to become president of a constitutional democracy. He comes out of retirement and he goes back in, and he really, it was said that he followed the Constitution the way a field commander follows a military manual, but he really did do everything in his power to be a good president. Finally, you know, it's a colossally long term, but in spring of 1932, he finally wants to retire for the third time. The guy's 84 years old, but if he doesn't run for a second term, it's almost certain Hitler will be elected. So he basically runs for president. He's clearly elected. But for him, it's basically a death sentence in office because he'll be 94. So he'll be in his 90s before the term is out. So I actually think, and he was doing this not in the service of democracy, not even the service of the Kaiser. He was doing this for the love of his country and his dedication to Germany and the idea of Germany as a country. Where I begin to fault him, I understand the appointment, but I think after the Reichstag fire and the laws that get implemented, I don't know if he just threw in the towel, if he was just too weary, but I think he could have kept Hitler much more under control than he did. He did force, Hitler tried to introduce some very early anti-Semitic legislation. Hindenburg forced him to retract some of this, but he did not do enough. And as I say, after when he appears in March with Hitler in Potsdam, you know, for this great event, for this PR opportunity for Hitler, that's kind of when I express dismay. I don't think it was senility to any degree. I think it was probably exhaustion, and he just wanted to go back to his estate on Neudeck and, you know, serve out his time.
I know it's my favorite quote about Hindenburg comes from Max Hoffmann, who'd been the previous commander at Tannenberg before he was replaced by Ludendorff and Hindenburg. And he was giving a tour of the battlefield, and someone said, where was the great field marshal? He said, well, that's where he was asleep over there when this order was given, and he was asleep over there when that division went in, and he was asleep. And that was in 1914.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, there is that about, you know, they used to say about George Washington, the reason he was commander is because you walked in, he was always the tallest man in any room. And I think Hindenburg, by his birth, by his endlessly long name, by his lineage, and by his very presence, was always given that. And there is a question of, you know, how much of these victories were Ludendorff and was Hindenburg just a figure for it. But that aside, I believe in the moral centering of the man. I believe there was this love of the German homeland and the German people, and he was one reason why he wanted to stay out of politics was during the Armenian genocide. He had been following some of that, and he was appalled by what politics could unleash. He said, "In the military, you go in there, you kill people, they kill you. When it's over, it's over. It's between soldiers killing soldiers to achieve a particular end." What he was appalled by were the passions, I think maybe the word he used, that could be unleashed by politics and religion. And was a military man like this. So whether he was given more credit than he deserved, I wouldn't necessarily argue with that. But I think for who he was, he was always true to himself, and had served his country, and basically just wanted to retire.
So, because it's History Hack, and we try to stay on the lighter side, and this is quite a serious subject, I think it's probably time we start talking about some of the stupid stuff and stupid people within this sort of time period, this time frame. I know we talked before we started about some of the, there's that sheen of Nazism that they had a plan and they were going somewhere and everyone knew what they were doing. But in fact, it was a complete, I can't think of a polite way to say the word shit show, but basically. So are there any glaring examples of people within the Nazis or within the establishment just being really, really dumb and making Hitler look like a laughingstock?
Well, I think Hitler made himself look like a laughingstock. His actions, his rhetoric, he was ridiculed constantly and endlessly. What is amazing is when you look at what the ridicule he subjected himself to, and he knew he was the butt of jokes, of ridicule, that, I mean, in every degree possible. One of the most popular was when Hindenburg dismissed him in August 13th. He said, after Hitler had left, he said, if I'm going to give that man any post in government, it will be as postmaster general, so he can lick the stamps with my face from behind. There's another cartoon of Hitler, and this is in January of 1933, Hitler standing in a cemetery, and all of the crosses are actually swastikas. And it's basically, it's called Der Neue Hamlet, you know, the new Hamlet, but it's basically Hitler standing in the graveyard of his movement. When he did, at one point, when he was on one of his more successful rides, this was, I think, before January 30th, but he did say, people were always laughing at me. No one's laughing anymore. And he vowed vengeance. Everything that followed, he had promised. I mean, he was open about it. But yeah, following the history in the day to day, the cartoons in the newspapers are hilarious. When he went back for another meeting with Hindenburg, it shows Hitler standing there, and there are these vultures circling overhead, and the captions underneath, "Whoa, here he is again." And it's like, this guy can't take it. But you do, you do wonder how this man had such resilience to this. I think it was this fanaticism, and the one thing that did drive him. I mean, if you'd say, what is it that, how did Hitler do this? It was this fierce, unrelenting, fanatical drive. I mean, to take any he just ignored defeats. You know, when he gets 37%, he does the math on it. You know, 37% is 75%, 51%, I should be chancellor. Anything that happened, he was seen in a positive light, and it was this fierce and unrelenting drive for this. Possibly the most interesting one was when he'd go to court. He was in court all the time, and we know about politicians who capitalize on appearing, at least in America, you get called into court normally, and it's a blemish on you. With certain people in America, they seem to gain political capital. It was just like Hitler. I mean, every time he went into court, he would grandstand. When he lost the election with, to Hindenburg by 6 million votes, he claimed voter fraud. He sued in court. He went before the judge, and the judge just looked and said, "You got to be kidding," and basically threw him out on his ear. But every time he went in, he actually gained political capital. And Hans Frank, who we talked about at the beginning, was Hitler's private lawyer in these things. And he said, you know, every time Hitler went into court, his enemies thought they were going to cause him political damage, but he always came out stronger. And it really was, you know, Hitler vowed to destroy democracy through the democratic process, and he really kept his word on that. He just was very smart about how he manipulated the system. At one point, one time in court, he was standing before a judge, and he outlined his vision. Article 1 of the German Constitution said that basically the government expresses the will of the people. And Hitler basically said, "I'm going to get the 51%. I will ultimately embody the will of the German people." The judge says, "So you're going to try to destroy democracy." And Hitler, I basically said that. And Hitler said, "Yes," he says, "but only through constitutional means." And Hitler said, "Jawohl." So it was all out there for people to see. There is actually an interesting observation. This is where you can blame Hitler for being a fanatic, but he was functioning in a democracy. And you also have to hold the German people accountable. There's a great German historian, Peter Gay, wrote on Weimar culture, himself had fled Germany in 33 or sometime in the 30s, ended up at Yale. But Peter Gay said that the Weimar Republic died twice. It was murdered and it committed suicide. You know, we know who committed murder, and the perpetrator is clear Hitler, but you know, this act of state suicide is much more complicated, especially when you're talking about a constitutional democracy with all the protections. You know, you have voting rights, you have freedom of the press, you have habeas corpus. It's all there. But the German people, maybe not in the majority, but enough of them allowed this to happen. And I think if there are any warnings or lessons from this, I think Americans may want to look at this. And actually, on this point, back in the 90s during graduate school, I taught a course in Weimar Nazi culture under a wonderful man, Richard M. Hunt, to whom the book is dedicated. But I remember using this Hans Frank quote about how the German democracy, you know, that the Nazis came to power just at the right moment, too far away from the Kaiser to retreat, not far enough into a full generation of democratic values to survive it. And I used to point to the United States as an example and said, look, you know, we've got 200 plus years of democracy. You can't, how much can you really fault the Germans for this? Well, now, that was 30 years ago, and I'm, you know, dismayed by what one has seen. And when one sees the resonances of Weimar, and I'm not actually saying, you know, Trump is not Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler is not, Trump is not a modern day incarnation. But I do think this determination, this fierce determination to destroy democracy or undermine democracy through democratic process is clearly there. But the more disturbing part is that in a democratic society where you do see such a large percentage of Americans, I mean, the Germans, 37% was Hitler's high watermark in the most, in the last truly open election. Keep in mind, when Hitler went to the polls again in March of 1933, this is a month after the Reichstag fire. This is when a lot of civil rights have been suspended. Hitler was still going for his 51%. He thought he was going to get a landslide. He ended up with 44% and change. And that was it. So he never in his entire political career ever had a majority of the Germans voting for him, which you can't say for Donald Trump. Anyway, sorry for the rant, but...
No, that's fair. Yeah. I was going to say, lose an election and call voter fraud. Heaven knows, that would never happen again.
Well, my favorite one was when Hitler was calling people for the November 4th. And this is verbatim. He told his people to be there. He said, "Es wird wild werden," which translates as basically "be there." It's going to be wild. So it's, yeah. And frankly, this vowing for vengeance, you know, when Trump basically said heads will roll, Hitler promised that. He said heads, when I'm elected, heads will roll. It took a year for it to happen, but, you know, we end up in June 4, 1934 with Night of the Long Lives when they really did roll, but he kept his political promises.
Yeah. So where, Strasser ends up dead. I think Schleicher's already dead at this point.
No, they had the same night. Yeah. There was a knock at Schleicher's door. It opened up. Said, General von Schleicher, jawohl, and a bullet through his head. Strasser was hauled off the same. He was shot and left to bleed to death in his cell. Ernst Röhm, you know, his street thug companion, one of the few people who addressed Hitler in that informal do form, I mean, a very close person, when he was stood up to be shot, they actually asked him to shoot himself. He says, if Adolf wants me dead, come here, tell him to come here and shoot me himself and put a bullet through him. So it's, house cleaning. But this is, and Chris, you wanted the funny stuff. But it was, you know, and as I say, what really struck me was just this phrase that Hitler used. You know, it was this ability to just put up with anything, this unwillingness to see anything as a defeat, just creating his own realities. And that really, whatever the word is, that haunting phrase, nobody's laughing now.
Timothy, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on this podcast. And we have to get you back because you have written some very interesting books that I personally would like to talk about that may or may not include concentration camps, which is, as very well many people know, is my specialty. And I didn't even get the word into this podcast, which is quite sad. But, you know, oh, hold on. Wait, yeah. I just did. Can you remind our listeners the name of your book?
Well, it's called Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. And the final is there because the guy just wouldn't stop. I mean, he just kept running and he run into these brick walls and again and again and again and again. And he kept doing it until he made it. And one thing that Hitler did have on his side, I mean, when you ask about his opponents, everybody hated Hitler except for the Nazis. I mean, communists, right wingers, centrists, you know, everybody hated the guy. But what the one thing he had on his side was the fact that he was 43 years old. He was almost half the age of Hindenburg. And he was a generation younger than most of his political appointments. Keep in mind, Hitler, had he failed in 33, he could have tried 10 years later, and he would have been 53 years old. He could have tried in 1953. In 1963, he would have been 73 years old, and he would have been younger than either Biden or Trump. I mean, the guy he came in early and he could have outlasted anyone on the, you know, in the political scene at that time. And he used to say that about, you know, he didn't worry about Hindenburg because he said, look, he said, you know, and he would say it openly. He said, yeah, this guy's going to be dead and I'm still going to be younger than any of you out there. So.
But talking of evil organizations, we'll try and get the book onto the History Hack bookshop so that people can buy it from us and independent booksellers rather than the evil organization of Amazon, where I'm sure they're just using the money for building Death Stars and build spaceships and stuff that we don't really need. And thanks again for coming down. We could probably talk all day.
Yeah.
It's been really, really good talking to you.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I love talking about this stuff. And
our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.